Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chissa Kores, the chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Kevin Kelly, senior maverick, Wired Magazine. Kevin Kelly, one of the true visionaries of our time, was editor and publisher of Whole Earth Review. He helped launch Wired Magazine and was its executive editor for the first 7 years. Kevin has been involved in such cultural innovations as the Hackers Conference, the early online community, The Well, and the All Species Inventory. His last book, New Rules for the New Economy, sold over 100,000 copies and hit the New York Times Business, Wall Street Journal, and Business Week bestseller lists. Kevin writes for publications including the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, Time, Harper's, Science, GQ, and Esquire. He is currently editor and publisher of the popular Cool Tools, True Times, and Street Use websites. Please join me in welcoming Kevin Kelly.
Okay. Thank you. This is probably more formal than we need to be with the number of people here. Thank you for coming out, braving the parade and the ticker tape and the craziness out in the street. I appreciate your coming out to hear what I have to say. I'm going to assume that most people here have not read the book, and so I want to talk a little bit about what the message of the book is. And I probably will maybe at times seem to kind of rush through things because really the whole purpose of this is to have some time to interact and ask questions. And by the way, I'm happy to answer questions that are not about the book but about Wired or whatever else we want to take. Because, in fact, my job at Wired, my role in general, is to think about things that are coming along, you know, next year, next couple of years, maybe next 10 years. And with this book, I'm doing something different, which is stepping back, way, way back, and trying to talk about the long-term trends in technology, the next 100 years, 1,000 years, maybe beyond, looking at that with a different perspective than the now, what's happening next. And I think that my main reason for doing that is to try and give a framework because, you know, I'm kind of an old hippie. I was involved with the Whole Earth Catalog. I didn't own very much. I traveled through Asia with very little. I spent a lot of time living in hamlets and places of the Himalayas or Afghanistan, Pakistan that had very little material goods. And I was interested in kind of keeping that to a minimum. At the same time, I'm involved with the latest stuff, the newest things. And in my own mind, that tension began to work on me because I realized I did not have a theory of technology. There was no framework. And that's what this book is. It's my quest to try and uncover a theory, a perspective that puts technology in a framework. So otherwise, it's just one thing after another. And that's sort of like what biology was before there was a theory of evolution. It was just one organism after another. I'm not suggesting that I'm Darwin or that I have a theory. In fact, what I wanted to do was to travel around the country and interview the 5 or 6 professors or philosophers who had sorted this thing out and had the theory of technology. But after a couple of years, I realized that there wasn't one. So I kind of spent some time trying to assemble a first draft, and that's what we have, is we have a first draft of a theory of where technology fits into the cosmos, and more importantly, what it might mean. And so I'm going to kind of give the basis of that. I'm going to actually use slides. I don't have to use slides, but I can. They're pictures. People like pictures. I like pictures. I was a photographer. There are not many words. This is a borrowed computer. Technology hardly ever works. That's one thing I know about technology. So let's see if this is going to do something. So this is the this is what we think of technology is normally. I mean, mostly in our kind of everyday thing. It's stuff that was invented after we were born, right? So we don't think about the clock and wires and the carpeting here and even the lights of the doorknobs. We don't think of them as technology, but of course they are. Another friend put it this way. It's another variation of that. It's anything that doesn't work yet. Okay? And if we don't think of those things, then we think that, well, it's anything that has an off-on switch or anything that might be in our pocket. And to some extent, that's true. That is one aspect of it, but of course it's much broader. And that's what I'm interested in. So I went for a very broad interpretation of it. We're forgetting, of course, in these definitions of these gadgets and stuff that surrounds us, that there's lots of intangibles. So the calendar is a technology. It was invented. It's very useful. Double-entry bookkeeping makes a huge difference. It actually allowed commerce to take place and expand very rapidly after the Venetians invented it. The Arabic numerals, of course. Even things like law, the very complex set of law that we have. This whole system, it's basically software for running a country. And those are the intangible parts. So certainly, when I talk about technology, I want to include that. But there's another important kind of a definition of technology, and it has to do with these two things. Okay, so approximately the same size. One of them, obviously, a tool, technology invented by prehistoric sapiens. That any one of them could have, maybe not anyone, but most of them could have made, at least some substitute for that. And that's what we call a tool. The other one is about the same size, and nobody here can make that one. In fact, all of us together couldn't make it. And that technology, the mouse, or maybe it's a cell phone, or it could be any of these devices, requires 1,000 other intermediate technologies for it to be made and maintained. And each of those intermediate technologies require maybe hundreds of other supporting technologies. And so that is a part of a web, an ecosystem of other technologies. There are no independent standalone technologies except for the one on the left. These days, our complexity of technologies are ecological. They're systematic. They are require and are codependent upon many other technologies. And so, in fact, the whole thing, everything around us, if we went through every objects in this room, we would quickly begin to see that there is a interacting network of self-supporting technologies. And what's important and something I'll come back to later is that oftentimes technology A is needed to create technology B, which is needed to create technology C, which is needed to create technology D, which is often sometimes needed to create technology A. So you have this circular, recursive support, kind of like the lap dance, where everybody's sitting in a lap and it just goes around and around, an infinite circle, the Ouroboros, you know, the kind of the tail, the snake eating its own tail. It goes around and around. There's no beginning or end. That's the kind of things that we have, and that's important later on because when we have systems like that, they produce certain kinds of effects. What I want to end this part definitionally is to say that my definition of technology, when I talk about technology wants, it is not the standalone mouse and iPhone. It's not even the set of all those. It's the interacting web, the system of all those things. And when you have systems, two things happen. One, we see behavior or phenomena that operates at the system level that's not found or present in the lower parts. So the common example would be like a beehive. So a beehive actually has a behavior, and that beehive behavior cannot be found in any of the bees individually. Individual bees have a behavior that's different than the beehive behavior. And so we see emergent behaviors arise at the level of the system. And then secondly is that because of that recursive loops, the kind of infinite loops I was talking about earlier on, what Douglas Hofstadter calls strange loops, it's, you know, these kinds of things that go round and around without beginning or end. When you have these networks that have a lot of strange loops, what happens is that you get patterns of that system that tend to veer in certain directions or come back to same recurring patterns or tend to migrate in certain directions. Okay, and so that is true for a mechanical, artificial system. It's true for living systems. It's true for any kind of large, complex system. Systems will tend to have their own system behaviors and tendencies. So what does that mean? I call that web of stuff not technology because it's confusing whether I'm talking about the individuals. I'm using it in a plural sense, so I give it a new word. I call it the technium. And the technium is everything that we make with our minds. It's the intangible, it's the calendars, it's the chairs, it's the old stuff, it's the new stuff, it's the stuff that has switches, it's the stuff that's been around long before you were born. It's all that stuff, and it's all connected together, and it's all codependent on each other, and it all exhibits an emergent behavior at the level of the system. And when I talk about what technology wants in technology, I'm generally talking about the technium, the system itself and not the parts. And when I say that it wants, which is right in the title, and it's very provocative in that sense, what I mean is in the way that a plant organism, a system of cells in a plant, wants light, that want that the technium has is not conscious, it's not intelligent, it's about as smart as a plant. But the plant, the little tomato, potted tomato in your windowsill is leaning towards light. There's a direction that it has. It's not conscious of it, but it's there. And the same thing with the technium. The technium has certain biases as a system. And so my quest was, what are the biases the technium has that are independent of our own choices? They're not completely independent by any means, and I'll get to that. But there's a level of autonomy that they are independent. So I begin with, in a curious way, I begin with the plants and what they want, because what I want to show is that evolution itself, evolutionary life itself, has a certain direction and bias. And I have to say, first of all, this is a minority view in the community of evolutionary biologists. You have very loud and opinionated and tremendously brilliant and wonderful writers like the late Stephen Jay Gould and others who argue that there is no direction, absolutely no direction in biological evolution. Anything, any direction that we think we see is something that we impose on it. And that's the orthodoxy. But there are a set of contrarian evolutionary biologists who argue that, in fact, there are trends, long-term trends in evolution, including the trends towards more diversity, variance, specialization, and complexity. And the reason why we're having trouble proving that is that we basically don't have a good definition of complexity, order, variance. And this is true. We don't. The physics don't. I mean, nobody has a really good definition of. If we could take two things, a cucumber and a Boeing 747, and say which one's more complex, we can't answer that question right now. We can't even take a cucumber and a tomato and say which one's more complex, or a cucumber and a bacterium. It's very, very difficult to actually quantify this, and that has really hindered our appreciation. Now, we intuitively have some sense that there's been a long progression from 3.7 billion years ago till now of increasing complexity and order. And even the most, you know, conservative, orthodox evolutionary biologist doesn't argue about the leading edge becoming more complex. Okay, so that's That's because, and the argument is, well, you start off with something simple, you have no choice, you have nowhere else to go but more complex. The real question is whether the trailing edge, the minimum edge, is getting more complex over time, or the middle. In other words, if you have something like a starfish, the level of a starfish, do we see long-term trends in the evolution where things actually evolve to become simpler than the starfish, from the starfish itself? And the answer is that there is generally not a drift towards more simple organization. There is generally a drift towards more complex, even not just at the leading edge, but throughout the entire biome. But it's very mild, as far as we can determine. But the problem is we don't really, first of all, because we don't have the definition, nobody has looked. So what I say is that we actually have an intuitive sense that there is this movement, that while we don't have good measurements, something in our brain, some pattern, we can recognize that, yeah, there is this sort of general movement where things become more complicated over time. And it's just, of course, not just becoming more complicated, they're becoming more diverse as well, increasing numbers of them. And that we also, again, have very good graphs. I don't have them, I'm not showing them here, but if you graph the number of families in plants or vertebrae or marine animals over millions and at least less than a billion, but hundreds of millions of years, you see the same thing where over time we have increasing species, increasing speciation, and we very rarely in any branch have decreasing speciation. So there are these movements that the orthodoxy is very reluctant to admit to because they don't have a mechanism for it, and that's basically the main reason why. There's not a good explanation for why that would be, and so there is a reluctance to acknowledge that it's there. So in addition to that kind of long-term trend towards complexity, there's one towards diversity, specialization, as I mentioned, mutualism, which is the idea that there's more and more interdependency among fellow beings. You know, there's more socialization. Insects become more socialized. Mammals, animals become more socialized. Even plants become more socialized. Ubiquity, there's a movement towards, you know, a few to many. Sentience throughout life. Mindfulness, little minute, tiny kind of thinking things from ants, insects, birds, mammals, reptiles. Mindfulness keeps wanting to happen. Evolvability is probably the most interesting and maybe a little difficult to explain, but what that means is that over time, the process, the larger process of evolution has actually evolved itself. I mean, it has changed over time. So the first bacterium had a very simple kind of evolution that was not at all sophisticated. As we had things like colonies, evolution evolved new ways for that whole system to evolve. So things like sexual recombination speeded up the rate at which things could evolve. So this was another level of evolution in evolution itself. So, and then exotropy, which is this increasing order, the increasing order and structure. So we have, you know, cells, and then cells become tissues, and tissues become organs, and organs become organisms, and organisms become societies and colonies, and so you have these increasing levels of order. That's what evolution wants. That's the long-term trend or bias in evolution. It doesn't kind of matter what those little individual organisms are doing, whether they die off or survive or go extinct or born. These trends push over on top of them. And, okay, that's life, but that's life, and that's not technology, someone might say. But, in fact, one of the great discoveries in the last 50 years has been the discovery that the essence of life is not bound into its wet tissue, that life ultimately is actually an information processing system, and the discovery of DNA – was one of the foundational things that changed people's minds to understand that it wasn't some kind of, Ilan Vital, some kind of spirit. It didn't reside in semen. It was something that was an information processing system that was set up and running through the genes. And we know this because we can actually take out some of the biological processes and move them into, let's say, computers. We can actually do 100% Darwinian natural selection in computers, and we can evolve code. And some of that evolved code is actually running in Microsoft Word. So parts of that program were not designed by humans. They were actually evolved in this process that was letting these bits of strings of code compete and breed just like they would in the wild. At the same time, we have examples of using our E. coli bacteria that's in our gut, E. coli, the kind of laboratory bacteria, to do parallel processing computation, solving a traveling salesman program, which is a kind of a canonical problem to solve. So here we have bacterium doing computer work, and then we have computers doing evolution. And so we can kind of get the sense that the kind of distinction we walk around in our heads, that there is some difference between the stuff that we make and living systems, is actually a lot blurrier than it appears. It's actually really one thing going through. Now, there's obviously a difference between a MacBook and a sunflower, but there's a lot more similarities than we think, and it's those similarities that I'm kind of stressing and to suggest, in fact, that we think of the technological realm as an extension of the same forces that are running through life. So we can array these in kind of like in the museum piece, as if they're different butterflies. They're just spark catchers from the 1700s. Oops, and we see the same thing. I went too fast. I don't know how to go back. But hammers become more specialized. They start off, we have one hammer, then we have specialized hammers for metal, for wood, for brass. We have a camera. We invent it first, just like the first cell. We have cells that become specialized over time in our own body, heart cells, skeletal cells. We do the same thing with a camera. We can have a general camera at first, and then we invent specialized versions, infrared or underwater, panoramic, and then we can take a specialized panoramic that maybe works underwater or infrared, and so we can keep specializing the specialization, and that's the general drift we see both in technological evolution in the technium as well as in the biology. And that similarity, I think, is so pervasive and parallel that we should think about the technium as an extension of the six kingdoms, the roughly six kingdoms of life, you know, plants, fungi, animals, and the three different periods of bacteria. Those six kingdoms, we actually have a seventh one coming out of the animals, which is the technium. Okay, so the technium is a continuation of the same self-ordering, same self-creation and variation, increasing order that we see running through life is running through the technium right now. And I call it the seventh kingdom of life. So then, if that's true, and this is my argument, which I make in the book, if that's true, then we can ask the question, what technology wants? And to the first order, again, I want to reemphasize that I'm not talking about a conscious thing, although when we make these things and we give them some autonomy, that we can really feel their wants. This is a robot, a working robot, Willow Garage near Stanford. And the thing about this robot is it has been programmed to try and find its own outlet to plug itself in to recharge its batteries. So that's all that it knows. It doesn't know where the outlets are. All it knows is it needs to recharge itself. And so it takes its tail and plugs it in when it can find an outlet. So it roams around, does other work, and whenever it gets hungry, it starts looking for an outlet that's free. And I have to say that if you stand between it and the outlet, you can feel its want. It definitely wants that power because it It wants you to move. It won't hurt you, but it'll try to go around you. It will wait until you leave. It wants, even though it's not conscious, not really intelligent. So what does technology want in that sense of an urgency, a tendency, a need? It wants the same thing that life wants, basically. The technium is moving towards greater complexity, greater diversity, greater specialization, greater mutualism, sentience, evolvability, and exotropy. So it's if we look at technology now today and we say, where is it going? It's going to become more complex. It's not going to become simpler, ever. It's going to become more diverse, more variations of it. It's going to become more specialized. Whatever it specializes is now, it'll become more specialized. Greater mutualism, codependent on other technologies. I mean, we have cars, and then we build garages for the cars, and we have radios for chips for the cars, and they're serving the cars, even indirectly us, but they're actually causing most of the technology in the world to deal with other technology. And increasing sentience, so we're adding little chips and mindfulness into everything we make, making more and more mindfulness in the technium, and we're of course increasing the evolvability very, very rapidly, making it easier and easier to evolve new things in the technium. As an example of that kind of long-term trend, let me just pull out one, which is this increase over time towards greater energy density. So this is measured by the number of ergs per gram per second that flow through the system over the duration of lifespan of the system itself. And it turns out that despite the fact that we think of the suns and stars as incredibly energy dense, actually more energy per second per gram per duration of the system flows through a sunflower than the sun. And even technology that we make in the technium is actually more energy dense. And the most energy dense thing that we know about in the entire universe is a PC chip, the chip in the PC. There is so much energy flowing through that as we try to put more through it, more computation, it's in danger of either exploding or melting. And that's actually the design challenge for most of the chip manufacturers, is like this thing is so intense, it's more intense than the sun. It could just, I mean, if it was, would an explosion, the sun is sort of like an explosion, it's unreleased, a nuclear explosion is unreleased, so all that power is going through in a very short time, it's not sustainable. But if you tried to sustain it, the chip would actually have more energy running through it per gram per second. So that's, again, I'm trying to show that there's a continuation, that we can actually arrange the things in the technium to show that they have predecessors, antecedents in life, and not just in life, but even further back in life. So if technology has its own agenda, what if it's sort of selfish, is what I'm saying. Part of it is selfish. One of the things that technology is doing is making more of itself. I did a calculation of how much power, and 3/4 of the power that we generate is used to service things that are not us directly. Like, for instance, in your car. When you drive a car, 3/4 of the power in your car is being used to move the car and not you. Okay, and so that number keeps changing higher and higher. So less and less of the total percent of the entire energy is going to be used to us. Most of it's being used to service the stuff around us. So from the technology, from technium's point of view, it's increasing itself. And the second thing we know about how technology works and what its agenda is comes from this remarkable phenomena, which I was really surprised by, which is that simultaneous invention is the norm in technology. It's what ordinarily happens, meaning that every invention is usually invented by at least one other, often two or three other people, at the same time independently. The light bulb was independently invented by 23 other people. Edison was the last first inventor of the light bulb. They're all different, but the basic concept was the same. And that's what I'm saying, is that the higher level macro vision of that is inevitable, because once you have the precursor technologies, that next step is inevitable. The actual rendering, the expression, the individual speciation is completely unpredictable, but the larger macro concept is inevitable. And this happens in prehistory. I did a study of the prehistory in, sequence of inventions on different continents when they were separated and no contact between, you know, South America and Africa. And the sequence of technological inventions was remarkably similar in each continent, suggesting that these larger scale forms of technologies are inevitable once the precursors are in place. And we have another example of Moore's Law. Everybody's sort of heard Moore's Law, which is this idea that computers, chips, get twice as fast, half as cheap every year. Now, the thing about that is that that's on an unwavering line. And it doesn't matter. I mean, there are people investing billions of dollars trying to make it go faster to get ahead of Moore's Law, and all they do is keep it on Moore's Law. And some people say, well, that's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. We all know where it's going to be, so we work very hard to make it happen. And that's actually what Gordon Moore himself thought. But it turns out that Moore's Law was happening before even Moore recognized it, before anybody believed it. And we see the same kind of curves on other things like solar panels or hard disks or bandwidth. They actually have the same kind of unwavering straight line of advancement, often years or decades before anybody believes that there's such a thing happening. So this is another example of the kind of an agenda, of an urgency, a tendency that's independent of our own actions, because often we're trying to make this happen faster, but it's not. It's just going along. And that would happen no matter where in the world it was taking place. So we also know, finally, that prohibition doesn't work. I did a study of prohibitions. Can we stop things? I mean, let's say you want to stop Moore's Law. You weren't just trying to make it go faster. You couldn't stop it. The prohibitions work locally. They delay things locally. That's the best that you can say about them. They don't last globally. They're routed around. They fade very quickly. They're quickly forgotten. So, and also, by the way, old technologies don't go away. This is a knife made exactly the same way that they were made 10,000 years ago. They're napped with the antler on pieces of leather. This technology has remained uninterrupted for tens of thousands of years. It's identical. And the idea that technology does not go away was something I suggested to a historian of science, and he said, oh, you know, well, they don't make steam power cars anymore, and so couple minutes on the internet, and I found out that actually you can buy brand new valves for your Stanley steam-powered car. They're making all the pieces of them. And so I went to look at the 1998 Montgomery Ward catalog of agricultural implements, and I said, surely these things are just going to be completely outmoded. Nobody's using these anymore. We went to see if we could buy them brand new, not antiques. I wanted to see if people were still making the brand new versions of, you know, what is it, a spray pump or a fanning mill. Who knows what a fanning mill is? They're all, you can get every single one of them. They're all still being made brand new. Somewhere in the world, someone is using and buying these things. And I told this to Robert Kerwich at the Radio Lab, NPR, and he was in total disbelief. And so he set an intern and a volunteer, and they spent a month going through the rest of the catalog looking for anything that was still, that they could not buy brand new. And he wrote me 2 weeks ago and said, you win. We can find everything. Things don't go extinct in the technium. That's the difference between biology and technology, is that biology extinction is real and often, and in the technium, things don't go extinct. So it's really hard to get rid of them. So technologies are inevitable. That's the surprise for me. The things that were coming down in the future at the large form are inevitable. The internet was inevitable. What's not inevitable is what kind of internet we wanted. Do we want one that's centralized or decentralized, transparent or opaque, flexible or not, government run or not? Those are the choices we have, not whether we're going to have an internet. And we can look ahead and say human cloning, it's inevitable. Our choice is only What's the system around it? How do we want to express that? Pilot, automatically driven cars, inevitable. Those things are coming. So we have made ourselves. We have invented humanity. Humanity is our first invention. We're the first domesticated animal. We have remade ourselves from the very beginning when we invented language and transformed ourselves. We made things like the external stomach called cooking that allowed us to digest material that we could not ourselves, and that gave us a new nutrition, and that nutrition actually changed our jaw and our teeth and our enzymes, and now we're dependent on it. And but it was an invention. It was something we invented. So our minds actually changed our heritable bodies. So our genes are now evolving 100 times faster than they were 10,000 years ago. We're rapidly changing ourselves still. You know, when we domesticated the milk-drinking animals, we changed the lactose for in our bodies. And with the invention of language, you actually had a population, the first population explosion, which went out around the world. We went from, like, you know, 8 to 10,000 individuals to you know, hundreds of thousands very rapidly. And we spread around the globe at the rate of 1 mile per year into every biome on the planet in a couple thousands of years. It was probably the fastest dispersal ever. And, of course, we also, with these very few tools, managed to eliminate 250 megafauna. So which upset an entire ecosystem. So long before the industrial age, our little tools had planetary effect. Okay, we were changing ourselves and our environment, even as hunter-gatherers. And we actually started to change the climate in agriculture age, before industrial age. Agriculture also had a planetary effect. So we were a planetary force, even from the beginning. And we are the technium and the technology is the most powerful force in the world now. So humanity is our greatest invention. We're not done yet. But one of the things that that should say technology is selfish, one of the things that we want to keep in mind is that the technium has some autonomy, and it is selfish. It does want to make more of itself. It does have its own agenda. At the same time, because we are a self-creation, so if you're a self-creation, that means you are the creator and the created, the master and the slave. Okay? Technology is selfish, and it serves us. That duality, that tension is inherent in us. We are the created and the creator. We will always be the created and the creator. We will always be the master and slaves of technology. So that tension, in 1,000 years from now, we are still going to be wrestling with the fact that the technium has its own agenda and is selfish, and the fact that we are part of the technium, and therefore we are the creators. That's going to continue. As we remake ourselves, we are going to, you know, remake ourselves. So we are the creators, we are the makers, and the made. That tension will remain. So we're forever going to have this duality. The question that a lot of people say, well, I can accept that, but, you know, are we going to become mechanical, you know, machines ourselves? Or are we going to have a techno planet? And I think that one of the things we learned about technology is that because it is an extension of life itself, there's no technology that we've invented that we cannot imagine or make a greener version, a more life-compatible version of it. Okay, so there's nothing inherently in technology that prevents this from happening. It's we can decide which expressions we want, but technology inherently is compatible with life. For instance, when they make these chips that we've been talking about, they demand a purity of water that even beyond what we demand to drink. So we can say technology wants clean water. So I mean, in a certain sense, because it grows out of and is an extension of life, it is compatible with life. The problem is that we tend to think, well, all this technology here, technology, new technologies, new inventions bring new problems. Let's be honest about that. Most of the problems we have in the world today are technogenic, meaning they were created by previous technologies. Most of the problems in the future are going to be technogenic, meaning they're going to, the stuff that we create in the future are going to create most of the problems in the future. So people say, well, the common kind of response is, well, technology is neutral. It kind of looks like a hammer. You can bonk someone over their head with it, or you can build a house with it. It's kind of up to you. Well, that's not entirely true. One of the responses to a technology that causes problems is to say, well, we need less technology. But I think technology is more like an idea. So if someone has a bad idea or a stupid idea, the response is not to encourage them to think less or for us to think less. The proper response to a bad idea is a better idea. Okay? And if there's a technology that's causing problems, for instance, we use DDT to spray as an agricultural pesticide over cotton fields in millions of acres. This was a horrible environmental disaster. That was a bad technology, as it was expressed. But the same chemical used judiciously sprayed around households is the best malaria deterrent that we have and saves tens of millions of lives a year. So here was the same chemical just moved over to a different location, a different role. This was a better idea. So the response is not less technology. If we have technology that's causing problems, the response is not less technology. The response to technologies that don't do what we want is actually more technology, better technology. So I think our jobs as parents are sort of to find the right job for our technologies. It's to find the right home for these things. I think just as there's no bad children, I don't think there's no bad technologies. We can just have the wrong friends, the wrong jobs, the wrong roles, the wrong description, and our job is to sort of move them to where they can be used most convivially. So what does technology want? It wants increasing diversities, options. It's moving towards increasing our choices, our opportunities, our choice, our freedoms of action. That's the long-term trend that it's moving towards. That's why people move to cities. That's why we're here and not somewhere else. It's because we have come. That's why we rarely go back into the past or into other places, because we don't want to surrender the choices and opportunities that we have gotten through the technium. I did a count of the number of objects in my house. My daughter and I went through, and I have about 10,000 technological objects in my house. I looked at the inventories of King Henry VIII when he died, and they counted up 18,000 objects in his estate, which doubled as the Bank of England. It was the entire wealth of England, 18,000 objects. So, you know, we're getting close. So even an ordinary person can have the diversity of new things that the technology brings and all those choices and options. But there's then one way in which we're much richer than even King Henry was, because all King Henry's wealth could not buy a $2 a tube of antibiotics that could save his life. Rothschild, one of the great wealthiest moguls of American history, died of an infection that could have been cured by $2 of antibiotics, but it didn't exist then. And King Henry, all his wealth, could not have a flush toilet or refrigeration or a comfortable ride for 100 miles. But this guy living in India could. He can afford all those things. And so in a certain sense, he's actually richer because of the options and opportunities that this city brings him than King Henry was. And I think what technology gives us is something we call that progress. That's what it is. It's real. It's a deep progress. It's flowing through both life and now the technium. And, we see a lot of pointing up when we measure longevity, education, choices. And that's what we're giving. But I wanted to do one last thing as I close. Wow, they're really having fun out there. They're headed towards us. I want to place this. I'm showing how technology actually is connecting us back to life. But I want to go even further, because I think it's important to understand that this continuation precedes even life. And it goes back actually to the Big Bang. The Big Bang is kind of a very mysterious thing, but one thing we know is that after the Big Bang, there was entropy running down. So the entire universe is running down to heat death. That's the basic inescapable law of physics that operates anywhere we know about. Nothing. There's no free lunch. There's always this cost of entropy. But while that's true, there are these pockets, galaxies and stars, where things maintain order and they build up order. So we have these galaxies spinning around, creating the opportunity for stars to form. And the stars themselves are basically kind of machines, a couple billion-year-old machine that actually pumps up and a furnace that makes heavier metal, heavier atoms from lighter atoms, and spews them out, and then they're gathered up by another star, and they're pumped up, so you have helium, hydrogen starting, and eventually you get metals as heavy as iron, and then they're collected into a planet, and that may have an atmosphere. So we have these stars which maintain or making order over time. And out of that order, that increasing order in the face of extropy, and we don't know why it's making, where is this order coming from, this innate drive to make order. And occasionally we have these, like a planet in our little neighborhood, where life extends that order, which has been built up on this planet in the face of the entropy in the rest of the universe. And you see, for 4 billion years, you see life increasing in order. And then there's mind, and then there's the technium, and you see the same thing, increasing diversity over time, increasing variety, increasing order, increasing complexity, and self-organization continues to organize itself over time. It's a remarkable story. And what I'm adding to this story right now is that the technium is just the latest in that long-term cosmic evolution from the beginning. That the technium is not separate from it. It's actually part of it. It's actually the latest step. It's an acceleration of that self-organizing force that runs through the universe. And so that when we think of this, it's not just that we're making gadgets. It's not just that we're going to the store buying stuff. It's not just that we are spending our days thinking of new things and that this is just frivolous. It's actually partaking in a grand story that began long ago, that's running through us and beyond us, of increasing the options and opportunities and diversity and the variety of in the world. And that's actually a great story. And the reason why it's really great is because what it's doing is bringing forth possibilities. So everybody here has a little different mix of talents and abilities. And oftentimes it takes something that we invented to make the most of that. So we took a guitar and amp to make the most of Jimi Hendrix. Okay, or it took the piano and the symphony to make the most of Mozart. Imagine the tragedy. Imagine the loss to our civilization and our own enjoyment of life if Mozart had been born before we had invented the piano, or if Hendrix had been born before we had invented the amplifier. What a loss that would be. And, of course, you can also say the same thing about Van Gogh and what a loss it would have been before, if he was born before we had made oil paints, or this guy before we had made the technologies of cinema. So that means today, somewhere in the world, there's a boy or girl who's a genius in something that we haven't invented yet. And so we have, in some sense, an obligation to align ourselves with this long trend that goes through the universe of increasing possibilities and options, to increase the variety of technology in the world so that those children will have that thing that would unleash their genius so they can share with us. Of course, they also need to give them the old technology of clean water and abundant food, but we want to bring to bear the possibilities of this long story that goes through the universe to everybody so that we can actually enjoy their genius. And I think that is what we're doing when we make more technology. It's just not more stuff. It's actually partaking in this really great long story. So I really thank you for your attention, and I will take some questions now. Yeah?
Can I just make a program identification for recording purposes? We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to What Technology Wants with Kevin Kelly. Now, I'm going to open the floor up to the Q&A, and I'll be passing on the microphone. So please raise your hand and speak into the microphone so that we can record your questions.
Okay. Yeah. Hang on a second there. Okay, there you go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Really brilliant stuff. Can I say that you're a person who has never met a technology he didn't love? Is that?
There are technologies. There are expressions of technology that I don't love. Nuclear bombs, weaponizing things. These are expressions. You know, so nuclear stuff is good. Nuclear power, good. Nuclear bombs, bad. So I think that's not true to say that I've never seen an expression. I mean, there's plenty of expressions of technologies that I think we should eliminate.
Okay. The reason I ask that question is because I get a sense from your presentation, you're optimistic about
right.
the impact of
right.
our technology on the environment that we're dealing with now.
Sure.
You're seeing some potential for some aspects of it that may, in fact, solve some of these issues and problems.
Yes. I mean, I'm hopelessly a technophilian in the sense that I think generally the solution to most problems of technology is more technology. So that puts me in one kind of category. So it's like, you know, again, just as I said, I think the problem to sloppy, stupid thinking is better, more thinking. It's not less thinking. Yeah, back there. Okay.
How close do you think we are to a quantitative description of complexity? What are some?
Well, you know, there's 42 different definitions that have been proposed for complexity, and some of them work in very narrow fields mathematically. How close are we? I don't know. If the right genius was born, maybe they might happen within 5 or 10 years. But I think part of what we have to do is actually try to mathematically understand what, say, exotropy is. And, you know, there isn't enough work being done. There's actually not enough work in science being done in general. So, I mean, I think the remedy for this would be, what I would suggest the remedy for a lot of stuff is, like, more money for science, more money for research, that instead of for bombs and airplanes and all that kind of stuff, or, you know, fighter jets. So, yes.
I'm curious. You didn't speak about mutants when you were talking about evolution.
Right.
What role does that play in your theory?
Mutants?
Mutants.
Yes. Well, mutants are sort of inevitable. In Darwinian evolution, every variation is a mutant. They don't always survive very long. But there's also, what's interesting about mutants is that a lot of mutations show that there is let's just take, say, mutations in humans. A lot of the mutations show that there's an inherent bias because they're not completely random. For instance, you'll find, like, cleft palate, say, or six digits, other kinds of deformities that kind of recur again and again. You would think that if it was totally random, that you would get, like, really, really weird things that we'd never seen before. But in fact, even the mutations in the mutants and the mutations are actually directed. They're not entirely free. And, of course, this is one of the things part of the heresy in my book is the fact that there's an emphasis on the fact that Darwinian natural selection is not the only force working through evolution. There are other things that tend to direct evolution through its paces. And the fact that the mutants kind of appear in a kind of a categorical way, again and again, is another example, actually, of this what we call convergent evolution, meaning things coming again and again, so it even shows up in the mutations. Yeah.
Any other questions? No? Yes?
This is a little bit of a strange question, but
yeah.
You're taking the global
view. Strange questions, that's the course.
I'd love to know how you see the Fermi paradox kind of playing into this, just because we're not maybe the only evolving system.
So let me just explain what the Fermi paradox is. The Fermi paradox says that we should just basically, if the universe is really as big as we think it is, and if all these things are kind of, life and things are inevitable, then why aren't we just surrounded by other intelligences trying to contact us? Is that the Fermi paradox that you're talking about?
Well, Enrico Fermi, the physicist, I believe in the 40s, mm-hmm. he was sitting around with other physicists, and he said, if there's other life out there,
right.
why haven't we seen it?
Right.
It's that question.
Sure.
And so no one knows the answer.
Right. So I don't have an answer to that. It is a paradox. The theories, just the theories are, is that, well, the distances are just so great, no one ever really overcomes faster than light travel or whatever, that those distances are just so huge, or that we're the first or the last, or that there's reasons people wanted to be hidden, or thirdly, that, these civilizations don't last very long. They're kind of like mayflies, and they're just never sustainable. So I don't know. I have no ideas. And I don't know if this suggests any solutions to that. So while I talk about the long term, I guess I'm not really thinking long term in that sense of what we're going to go. But I would say that one of the good news is that we're making kind of a global culture. The bad news is that there's only one of them. I mean, this is always the paradox when you have anything planetary, is that the good news is that the more layers we add, the more robust it is, the more integrated we become as one culture, as one organism, as one kind of internet thing. The bad news is that the good news is that it's less and less susceptible to perturbations or disaster. The bad news is that if it does really die, you're dead. And the same with our bodies. Our bodies are it's actually very difficult to kill a human. I mean, we're actually we've made these things to be very, very resilient. We've made them. Evolution has made them to be very resilient. But of course, once you're dead, you really are dead. And so I think this is a paradox that we have coming up, which is that we are making one thing which will be ever more resilient, but also there's only one. We don't really have a backup, so to speak. Is that a question back there? No, okay.
Any questions?
Yeah. You get one more there. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. You need the microphone.
Oh, okay. You're probably familiar with Thorsten Veblen, the technologist, social scientist of the last century. And he was concerned with the relationship between technology and culture.
Right.
And one of the things that he seemed to feel was very important was that there were situations where you could transpose a technology and take it to a place where it hadn't developed in the context of that culture, mm-hmm. like Japanese prior to World War II,
mm-hmm.
got the technology, and the technology just took out tremendously very quickly without a lot of moral constraint because it hadn't developed.
Right, right, right. Well, good.
What do you see happening? Do you see the same interplay happening now? For example, we've got countries that have just been part of the Soviet
right,
Union
right.
are now becoming democratic. And they're getting the technologies.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that interplay affecting them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was certainly true. I mean, in my own travels around the world, I think that's happening less now. I think there really is much more of, I mean, I look at the young people today around the world, and they seem to be listening to the same music, watching the same movies, reading the same books, going to the same websites, studying the same thing in school. And I think there's a lot less of that kind of displacement that you were talking about before and now. And I think that, you know, that kind of universality breeds its own problems, by the way. I mean, I was never very concerned about the digital divide. This was something that came up when we were starting Wired. People were concerned about all these, you know, they were mostly young males. They're all on the internet. You know, what about the rest of the world? What are we going to do? How are we going to get them on the internet? And I'm saying, you don't have to worry about that. The profit mode or the attraction is so great, they're going to come stampeding on. If you want to worry about something, let's worry about what happens when everybody's on all the time, 24 hours a day. So I think when things become ubiquitous, there's actually a phase change. They flip into things. So one of the techno-literacies that I think my book talks about or shows is that if you really want to think about the consequences of a technology, you really have to think about what happens when it becomes ubiquitous. So, okay, genetic sequencing of genes, kind of interesting. You know, maybe there's 100,000, 200,000 people have done it. That's kind of, if a million people could do it, that might be really cool. If it would only cost $100 and a couple million people did it, that's important. But what happens when it's like free and everybody's doing it five times a day? That changes everything. That's just a whole different game. And I think most of the things that we're looking at, teleportation, that would be really cool. But if everybody's teleporting all the time, that changes it. And so the displacement, I think we're in an era right now of not so much the displacement being a factor, but this concern about ubiquity. That is, I think, where a lot of these technogenic problems are going to arise. It's like when everybody has them all the time.
Okay, we have time for only one last question.
Okay, better be a good one.
Thank you very much,
no
Mr.
Pressure.
Kelly. This is, I feel no pressure. As I sit here and listen to you and your optimism, which I appreciate, I hope that it is that way. But I also hear very strong cautions coming from you as well, your comments about the bomb as well as things that we haven't yet invented. As you looked back, as you looked at the evolution of the technium, did you see the political systems evolving to handle all of this complexity?
That's a fair question. Because I see political systems as another example of technology. They are something that we create. They are a different type of technology, and it may be that we probably don't have as much diversity in them as we would like, or we don't pay attention to them as much. But they are certainly a technology, and I believe they have evolved over time. And I think this kind of experiment that we're going on with the Constitution. To me, the most interesting aspect of the Constitution is the clause of amendment, which, in other words, the clause that allows you to amend the Constitution. And this is that recursive nature of, like, you have something set up, and here's how you change the thing that you have. And there's lots of issues around that. Should that be more difficult? Should it be more difficult to change the Constitution than it was to pass the Constitution originally? Are you going to penalize future generations? This idea of equity, future equity, generational equity and things like that. So, I'm just giving one example of the fact that I do believe that there has been an evolution in political systems. I think we're nowhere near done, and that is something that this revolution in communications that we're involved in right now can assist in. Is making up new ways to relate to each other politically. In other words, basically new ways to arrive at compromise, which is what I think politics basically is. It's a way to arrive at a compromise. And so right now what we're exploring for the next decade or two is we're seeing how far the bottom can go by itself. We're seeing how far you can go with this social stuff of just doing anarchic, self-organized, bottom-up stuff. And the answer is that it won't take us all the way, but it always takes you a lot further than we thought, and it's a good place to begin with. And, I was a disbeliever in when Wikipedia was called Newpedia, and it was first starting, and I was one of the first people hanging there, and I thought, I'm not sure this is like an encyclopedia that anybody can edit. This is not... That doesn't seem theoretically possible. It was not theoretically possible. It was only possible in practice. And I think that it just went a lot further than even I believed it could go. And I think that's what we're discovering, is that Wikipedia is going to become more and more top-down as it goes along, more and more editors involved. So in order to get where we want, this ultimately reliable, wide, fast encyclopedia, we'll have to have more layers. But it went much further just from the bottom than I ever thought possible. And I think with the politics and things, that's sort of the answer where we are right now, is that I'm looking to these kind of social lateral engagements to begin these things. We're not going to be able to go all the way with them, but they're going to be a really great place to begin. So I really thank you for your attention, especially given the competition. You could be out there partying, but thank you again.
Our thanks to Kevin for his comments here today. And we also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.